Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Dave Zirin. He's the sports editor for The Nation and a columnist for The Progressive and the host of Edge of Sports podcast. He's also got a new book out, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Dave is the author of a number of previous books, including Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, and Jim Brown, Last Man Standing. Dave, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let me just start with a very basic question about the book. You know, there's been a ton written about Colin Kaepernick. And so I was wondering, how did you get the idea to write this book and why write it now?
Well, the book itself is not so much about Colin Kaepernick as it is about the chain reaction that took place after he took his knee and the way that spread to athletes around the country. High school, college, and professional. And the book is grouped in those three sections, high school, college, and professional, and how taking a knee changed the lives of the people with whom I speak, how it changed their relationship with their coaches, their community. So I didn't think this was a story that had been told yet. That was the first reason why I wanted to do it. And I came up with the idea after a conversation with 1968 Olympian John Carlos, who so famously raised his fist on the medal stand at the Mexico City Olympics that year. And John Carlos said to me in a very offhand way a couple years ago, you know, a lot of people raise their fists, a lot of young people, at track meets and sporting events after we did it in 68. And that immediately sent the amateur historian in me on all sorts of flights of thought, like who were these people? What happened to them? You know, after they raised their fist, what did it mean in terms of their relationship with the broader movement? And I knew that that book probably could not be written. I mean, it's been over 50 years and had no leads, but it did make me think very, very seriously about all of these stories, some of which I'd written, about these one-off stories of this one high school where people might have taken a knee, or this one college where someone took a knee, this one volleyball team, this one cheerleader, all of these stories that I'd sort of seen as one-off stories. And I thought, let's have something holistic. Let's have something that actually saves these stories from being memory-holed and forgotten in the broader history of what's taken place. Now, that was the first reason for doing the book, but then it went to another level during the summer of 2020 while I was working on it, and you had the killing of George Floyd by Officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, which led to the largest protests in the history of the United States that summer. And so I went back and called a lot of the folks who I'd interviewed already to that point to find out how they were reacting to these new protests, and they were all in the streets. They were all people who were organizing. And that made me realize that while many roads may have led us to the summer of 2020, one of them runs through the athletic fields of this country. And that story I really wanted to tell.
So I want to get into exactly those effects that you're talking about, but I do want to go back in time just for a minute here to the moment of Colin Kaepernick taking the knee, just to remind our listeners for the context here, why that specific gesture for Kaepernick and not another like John Carlos's 1968 raised fist?
You mean why did it resonate?
Why the knee? What was Kaepernick's decision about the knee?
Okay, yeah, the knee is I think a fascinating story in and of itself. Because Colin Kaepernick, when he first decided to not stand for the national anthem in protest of police brutality and racial inequity, he does it in August of 2016 by just sitting on the team bench behind his teammates. And it might have been something that had gone unnoticed. It might have been just a one-week thing. Colin Kaepernick did not put out a press release that he was going to do this, did not send so much as a tweet. He was just yet another person in this country who in August 2016 was very upset about policing in the United States. There had been some high profile killings that summer. The names Alton Sterling and Philando Castile might be, people might remember those names. And the videos of those shootings went viral and went public. So there was a lot of anger, a lot of protests in the country. And Colin Kaepernick was just another person who was upset. So he sat during the anthem. And it might have gone unnoticed, quite frankly, except that there was one reporter, really just one, named Steve Weiss, who I interviewed for the book, And he knew something was up because he'd been covering Kaepernick since college. He followed his social media and just knew that there was a story there based on what he'd seen Colin post. So Steve makes a beeline for Colin and asks him why he's sitting during the anthem. And when Colin gave his reasons, the fallout was immediate and very intense. I mean, Kaepernick certainly had supporters, but the detractors were at a much higher volume. And it was really a perfect storm because you had the presidential election. Donald Trump took this up as an issue to demagogue around with a hard racial bent. I mean, it was a very ugly scene. So Colin Kaepernick, he met with a former Green Beret and NFL player named Nate Boyer. And they talked about how Colin's protest, which again was against police brutality, was being reframed as somehow against the military or against the flag and all these things that had nothing to do with why he was doing what he was doing. So he and Nate Boyer spoke and came to this idea of taking a knee, because what they thought that would do would be to actually calm the waters and turn down the temperature on the whole thing, because taking a knee is associated with prayer, with solemnity. And it would be a way to show that you understand the solemnity of the moment, but at the same time, you're still registering your dissent. I think it's safe to say that they made a miscalculation there because it didn't turn down the volume on this. If anything, it just threw a ton of gasoline onto the fire, to mix my metaphor. And the reason why it did was because, you know, they learned a lesson that a lot of people have learned in this country, unfortunately, which is that if people don't want to hear your message, they're not going to share. They're not going to care how the messenger chooses to dress it up. If anything, it made things more intense, because I think the people who were against what Kaepernick was trying to do, I think they immediately intuited that what he was doing was something that was going to be iconic and something that people could replicate. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, Kaepernick taking that knee was on the cover of Time magazine. And so it was like this iconic pose, although fascinatingly, the cover of Time, because this is just the way history is told in this country, has Kaepernick in isolation, just on one knee, ignoring the fact that his teammate Eric Reed, who I interviewed for the book, was also on one knee, but also ignoring the fact that the knee gesture was already spreading to dozens and dozens of high schools and colleges around the country and in sports well beyond football.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation and the author of The Kaepernick Effect. So, question about football and here, and it goes back a bit again, and then we'll get more to the effects, but some sports analysts saying that Kaepernick's problems in finding another team were as much about the decline in his skills as a quarterback, as much as teams just not wanting the controversy and perhaps losing fans or revenue. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's definitely not true from a football perspective. If you look at, I think Colin Kaepernick's 2016 season is kind of remarkable, because he effectively takes part in this protest of taking a knee during the anthem for four straight months. I mean, really a remarkable act of endurance, given the fact that anytime he was out of the Bay Area doing this protest, he was greeted with not just boos, but, you know, death threats, garbage, hostile media. And yet he kept it going for the entire season. And after four games that year, where the 49ers were, for some unknown reason, starting a quarterback named Blaine Gabbert, Colin Kaepernick played the last 12 games, started the last 12 games, and he threw 16 touchdowns, had only four interceptions, and led the entire National Football League in yards per carry. And he did all this despite being on a team that led the NFL in dropped passes. So it was really quite a season, and certainly one that would warrant another chance somewhere else, even if he in San Francisco, there was a mutual agreement that they'd probably seen the end of their days together. But the idea that he wasn't picked up by anyone else, I mean, is a total act of collusion. because NFL owners decided that Colin Kaepernick had more value as a ghost story by which to haunt a young generation of players to make sure that they stayed in line and they stayed disciplined than they cared about winning games, which really goes against the NFL ethos of Vince Lombardi. You know, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Well, according to NFL franchise owners, it clearly was not the only thing. Far more important to them was, for lack of a better term, labor discipline and making sure that no other athletes dared speak out.
What about this argument that athletes should really just focus on their jobs as athletes, their performance, and avoid politics? I mean, has that ever been true?
I mean, first of all, it's never been true. Politics is baked into the cake of sports. To say you don't like politics in sports is like saying, it's like being served a chocolate cake and you say, hold the chocolate. I mean, it's there, whether you want it to be there or not. It's like, you can choose not to believe in gravity, but it's not going to help you if you're falling out of a plane. And we can speak about why that's the case. I mean, when professional sports start in the late 19th century, it's built on this myth of inclusion and reality of exclusion. The myth of inclusion in that when sports as a professional business entity start, it's billed as being representative of the United States in the best possible way. That's the ultimate meritocracy. Anybody who's good enough can make it, the best players take the field, you know, this whole meritocratic mindset. Yet the reality was that, you know, women were excluded from sports. If you're a person of color, it's, you know, make your own leagues because these are going to be white only operations. And so it was built on a reality of exclusion. So you see throughout the entire history of sports, this fight for inclusion, this fight for the level playing field that was promised when sports began. And so that's always made sports a political proposition. And when you factor and layer on top of that, the way that the powers that be in this country have always seen sports as an effective vehicle for whether it's patriotism, nationalism, even militarism. I mean, so sports has always been a political vehicle. And so when players say, well, hey, if this is a political vehicle, here's what I have to say about politics, I think a lot of fans freak out, partly because they want to go to sports, they say, for escape. But I think it's actually more rooted in the fact that when people say sports and politics don't mix, what they're really saying is sports and politics that I disagree with don't mix. And players are responding to that by saying that's hypocritical nonsense. And that's where we are right now, at this landscape of sports and politics. The wine is very out of the bottle. And a lot of athletes that I speak to feel like it's actually their responsibility to use this incredible platform, particularly living in, as we live in a time of protracted crisis, division, disease, that it's their responsibility as community leaders. And people always say that about athletes. You know, they want them to be leaders. They want them to be role models. But they want them to be a very depoliticized version of what we understand a leader and a role model to be. And that was certainly the case for a lot of years. And I think athletes are now saying, actually, politics is about taking a stand and you can't be neutral on a moving train.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with the nation's sports editor, Dave Zirin. We've been discussing his new book, The Kaepernick Effect: Taking a Knee, Changing the World. So I want to pick up exactly before the break on what you were speaking about there and how that politics is baked in. And it's, but it seems to be baked in differently for different people. And you mentioned the division in this country. And on this program, I talk a lot about politics, and I have talked a lot in the last few years about the depth of political polarization and this country, the hyper-partisanship, just how far it extends into our lives. And you, as you have very eloquently laid out, sports is no exception to that. Here's the thing I wanted to ask you about, though, on this. The way Kaepernick is viewed is by different people obviously has a lot to do with that political polarization, and you talked about that before. But here's a different example. Tom Brady. he supported Donald Trump in 2016. He's been a longtime friend of the former president. Yet it doesn't seem to have had the same blowback on him and on his reputation as the greatest quarterback ever, the GOAT. He was even able to joke with President Biden about some of the false claims that Trump has circulated about the 2020 election. So how come he's been able to avoid that political trap?
Well, two responses to that. I mean, first is that I think Tom Brady was able to try to communicate to people that his friendship with Trump was independent of politics. Like, and a lot of us, you know, because Tom Brady has never said like, yeah, we need the border wall, or, you know, speaking at the Republican National Convention, or saying we need a Muslim ban in this country. So Tom Brady kept it at the level of personality, like, oh, Trump's a famous rich guy, I'm a famous rich guy, we both like golf, therefore we play together. And I thought Tom Brady, you know, several times when the Patriots won the Super Bowl, you know, he rather conspicuously avoided being at the White House for the photo op. And it's the worst kept secret in the world that Tom Brady's wife, Giselle, the world famous model and businesswoman, that she loathes Donald Trump. So there was a lot there that complicated that relationship to make it just straight up like, oh, Tom Brady is a Trumper 100%. And then I think him showing up at the White House with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to meet with Joe Biden and his little joke, it's all like these, because Tom Brady is very, very concerned with his image above all else. And Donald Trump is image kryptonite. I mean, like, you associate with him, you're associating with some really, really scary stuff. And some people are happy to ally with that, but a public figure like Tom Brady, particularly one who works in a business where 70% of his coworkers are Black Americans, clearly kept Trump more at arm's length than I think a lot of people maybe thought he would when they first saw that Make America Great Again red cap in his locker in 2016. But there's another hypocrisy there as well that we have to realize, is that Black athletes who have used sports as a platform to speak about Black liberation have always borne the brunt of criticism from what is a majority white fan base. And we see this again throughout history. I mean, are we talking about Jackie Robinson? Are we talking about Muhammad Ali? Are we talking about Tommy Smith and John Carlos? Are we talking about Kurt Flood? I mean, are we talking about Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf? The examples are absolutely legion, that there's that white sports fans want to be able to consume Black excellence without hearing about Black politics. And that's something that Colin Kaepernick ran straight into the teeth of during the last 5 years.
Now, your book is about, as you said, it's divided up into these three categories of high school, college, pros, the effects of this. And you're telling a collective story there, but you're also looking at individual stories as you do that. And I wanted to know, is there one story that you came across that has stayed with you more than any of the others?
Well, I'm going to be very frank with you. All the stories have stayed with me in a very, very profound way, because, you know, these young people, that they trusted me, you know, and I'm still amazed I was able to get them on the phone and talk to them. I mean, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and, you know, if you actually call her, if I'm her dad, and if I call her, she's like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And I say, "No, I'm just seeing what time you're getting home." And she goes, "Oh, well, you called." And I thought it was an emergency. I mean, these young people, they don't take phone calls. So they text, you know. But when I started writing the book, it was the start of the pandemic. And the people I was trying to track down, which I did through, you know, internet searches and database searches and trying to message people over social media. I mean, they were home and bored. So they were happy to talk on the phone, and they gave me a lot of their time. And so I feel kind of attached and bound. I also did something that I never normally do, but I wanted to, since so many of the people I spoke with were so young. I sent them their sections of the book when I was done with them and said, "I want to give you a chance to either edit this or say you don't want to be in the book." Because I really want you to be comfortable with this, because this is your life and it's about to go out there to the public. Because people talked about some very personal aspects of what took place after they took that knee.
Yes.
Problems with coaches, problems with friends, death threats. I mean, some personal stuff. So, but only one person of everybody I interviewed said, "Yeah, I don't think I want to be this public in the book." And so I just feel it, and I feel bound to her too, frankly. Like, I feel bound to all of them for even giving me the time. But that's a long way of saying that this one young man I spoke with, Rodney Axon Jr., who was the first person to take a knee by my calculations and research after Colin Kaepernick, his story really sticks with me because he really thought that by taking a knee at his school in Brunswick, Ohio, his high school, it was going to lead to a discussion that could make the racism that he dealt with in his locker room and in his community, he thought it would make it better. And maybe it will make it better in the long run because he forced people to have a lot of uncomfortable discussions. But a lot of the uncomfortable discussions came less from the knee he took during the football game than it did from the terrible backlash he received and the publicity that that backlash revealed about Brunswick, Ohio.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Dave Zirin. So you have also written a biography of Jim Brown. I mentioned that in the intro to the program, and his complicated personal and political legacy. And obviously, he's one of Syracuse University's greatest athletes. Do you think there are any important similarities between Brown and Kaepernick?
Well, first of all, I think we got to say, Syracuse, that's an amazing thing to say about one of Syracuse's greatest athletes, because maybe he is one of, but he also is in the discussion for maybe the greatest athlete the United States has ever produced. I mean, when you look at Jim Brown's history as not only somebody who's arguably the greatest football player, but people also in the lacrosse world speak of him as being
Right.
arguably the greatest lacrosse player.
Ernie Davis is in a conversation here at the university when we think about that, but go ahead. Go ahead.
I
Yes.
get it. Oh, I
Yeah.
get it. No. I mean, Syracuse is a special place in that regard. It's like when people say, who's the best point guard to ever come out of the Bay Area? And some people say Jason Kidd, and other people say he's not even the second or third best out of the Bay Area. And then other people will say Jason Kidd's the best point guard ever in the entire country. Not, but and so it, when you have an area of such concentrated athletic excellence, it's interesting. But Jim Brown also, like, he once scored over 50 points in a Syracuse basketball game and then quickly quit the team. He was once a top 10 triathlete, I mean decathlete, without actually training for the decathlon. He never played baseball and was offered a contract from Casey Stengel to play for the Yankees. So there's a lot there with Jim Brown that's very intense from an athletic perspective. I think they're Jim Brown and Colin Kaepernick have very different politics. Jim Brown was extremely critical of Colin Kaepernick for taking a knee during the anthem. Jim Brown later came forward as a Trump supporter, even though Trump had piled racism on Colin Kaepernick. That didn't stall Jim Brown's support of Donald Trump at all. So there are a lot of differences in that regard, but I'll tell you where I see a strong similarity in that, when Jim Brown played in the National Football League, he was the first player to ever have an agent. A lot of people don't know that. His nickname by management to Jim Brown wasn't the great Jim Brown or the guy who won us the 64 championship or anything like that. Their nickname for Jim Brown in management circles was very derisive. They called him the locker room lawyer because he was the person who always stood up to them, and he had so much power because he was a great player. Such a great player, he could do things like kibosh trades when they were trading people that he didn't think should be traded. I mean, and that was a lot, and they resented his power. And then, of course, Jim Brown so famously leaves the NFL at age 29 when he's still at the height of his powers because he doesn't believe he's being treated like an adult. And interesting that age 29, because that's also the age that Colin Kaepernick found himself really blackballed from the National Football League. But the comparison is that the NFL is a very, very, very authoritarian operation. It's very top down, and players are there to obey. And in Jim Brown and Colin Kaepernick, you have two people who really threaten the entire status quo of how the league is supposed to operate for the simple reason that they refused to play by the rules of ownership. And that made them detested in a lot of circles, and it also made them a lasting inspiration for the players around them.
So we've only got about a minute left. I want to try to squeeze two questions in here at the end. But the first one is, very briefly, what's Kaepernick doing now?
Well, Colin Kaepernick now is getting ready for, I think, a very busy 2022. He's got a Netflix series coming out that he's doing with the great director Ava DuVernay about his life. He has several books coming out. So while Colin Kaepernick has chosen silence for most of the last 5 years, I think we're going to hear a lot more from him in the next year.
And then finally, what do you think Kaepernick, and again, briefly, what do you think Kaepernick thinks the Kaepernick effect is?
I think Colin Kaepernick understands that as a symbol of resistance, he was able to provide a method of struggle for a generation of young athlete activists. And I hope he understands that that lasting effect is one that's going to echo throughout generations.
That was Dave Zirin. He's the sports editor for The Nation. And again, his new book is titled The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. And you can also hear him on his podcast, Edge of Sports. Dave, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. This was fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.